The findings of a Royal Commission into Family Violence in Victoria has found that men who commit violence against women have largely been protected by the current system. The Commission's report says it's unintentionally made them invisible and provided opportunities for them to avoid responsibility. Now there are calls for a system behaviour change to stop unintended colluding with perpetrators in a way that allows men to slip through the loopholes. Dr. Kristen Deemer is a sociologist with specialist interest in family violence and sexual assault. She's analysed the recommendations from the Royal Commission and joins us from our Melbourne studio. Kristen, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, what can you tell us about this report? What did it find that we perhaps hadn't realised before?
Sure. Well, I guess if you talk to people in the sector, there's probably not a lot that's new. I think the way that it's pulled together illustrates that they've listened to the submissions. They've really considered what was being said to them, and that I feel like they've pulled it together in a meaningful and, apart from the substantial weight of the physical volumes of it, in a digestible way. I think the way that the recommendations are expressed and the way that the keys throughout the report, you know, they've referenced different sections to look at and how they kind of overlap. So I think as a report that goes to government trying to recommend a pathway, I think that's what's new in this. It's sort of given them a whole of system pathway to follow.
We often blame the system and say, well, the system needs to change. What does the report say about that?
Well, I think that's one of the best outcomes or the best recommendations in this report. And it's not just one recommendation. It's filtered all the way across the report. It talks about how systems need to work together. So it has not shied away from the difficult issue of system and organizational change. That's a big, big step to take. In the same way that we're asking men to change and not to be violent, we are asking organizations to change and work differently with other organizations to then hold men to be accountable for their violence.
Excellent. Well, that's good news. Now, I did hear something about male perpetrators being invisible, and I thought, well, hold on, how can that be? These people are beating the daylights out of women repeatedly.
Yeah, well,
does that mean they're invisible to the system?
They're invisible to the system, but I think that's. But there's 2 points to that. First of all, it's easy to see physical violence. We can see the evidence of it. You know, apart from bruising people in parts of the body, you can't see. But it's much easier to see physical violence. We don't necessarily see the other forms of control, the financial abuse, the emotional abuse, isolation, and our system's not very good at recording that and following up on it. It's minimized and trivialized a lot. And we don't have good systems. I guess when you think about it, the family or violence in the home is a relatively new criminal offense for most states and jurisdictions around the world. And it's still we're still passing Family Violence Protection Acts in some countries. So our courts and justice and police systems are still catching up and finding ways to, you know, actually think about what does domestic and family violence look like.
Well, what about the recidivism of perpetrators? What can you tell us about that?
Family violence doesn't necessarily happen just in single incidents. Well, very rarely will it happen in a single incident. But what we see with police data, and this is where we can see perpetrators most clearly, is they are recording incidents. They attend an incident and they record what's going on or what's happened that particular day. But they're not recording what might have happened beforehand, which might have happened the day before, the week before, the years before. So if it's
can I just interrupt you? Does it mean this, that there's not a database which police who are attending a domestic violence issue can access on their phone, say to them, there have been problems at this house before or with this man before, and get details of it?
Well, they can if it is recorded in the police system. So if there's been another police incident, recorded incident in that state.
I understand about the cross-state border problems when people move, but are you saying there's not enough recording in the police database of incidents because they're not reported, or police don't think it's important enough, or what?
I think there's a combination of things happening. There are some police who are not very good at asking the question whether this has happened before. There's some police who don't record the full information, so they may not, when an incident happens. And only recently have we made it, actually, in Victoria in particular, sort of mandatory that if you're called to a family violence incident, you actually have to file a report. It's sort of in the last 10 years. So prior to that, the victim could say, no, I don't want to press charges. And that still happens to some extent where there's a lot of pushback. So those incidents go unrecorded. But there may
Do you know if that's the case in other states, that it's mandatory for a report to be filed?
Well, it will be mixed across the different jurisdictions. Mm. And it all really comes down to, and I don't want to talk about police practice necessarily, except that the supervision, you know, is really important in policing family violence. And in Victoria, they've spent a lot of time working on their systems and training and educating and looking at the supervision processes. They're trying to, that we do have a longer history recorded.
We had a guest on this program last year, I think, who suggested that we should get rid of apprehended violence orders. And she works in the family law system in New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
And her reasoning, if I can sort of paraphrase it, was they came about because of the community concern about domestic violence, saying, well, we have to get something done. Look to the politicians. Why don't you do something? So what can politicians do? Well, they can give more money in grants to services, or they can pass laws. So they passed a law saying, well, help keep the guy away. But she says all that's happened here is that the police say, oh, we'll get an apprehended violence order and keep him away. In other words, they see it as a step to not so much avoid, but a step that must be taken in a sense, whether they think of it as an absolute must, but in practice that's how it happens, rather than, you know, charging the guy with assault. What do you say to that?
I think this comes back to, again, the different forms of violence, because not everything is an assault.
No, I accept that. Yeah. But in the case where it is, what do you say?
Okay, well, yes, they can charge him with an assault, and it'll depend on, you know, the severity and all of that. But
do you think they should get rid of apprehended violence orders?
No, I don't think they should get rid of apprehended violence orders. I think that there's a range of responses that should be had. And if you come to the, you know, most victims of violence in the family don't actually want the perpetrator to go to jail. They actually want the violence to stop. And so I think it's looking at what are the systems that we have in place that can hold him to account so that he does stop the violence. And often an intervention order, as we say in Victoria, an apprehended violence order, is not enforced. So we have the piece of paper that says that he should stay away, but there's nobody to actually enforce that, or we don't have good systems for enforcing that. Even to the extent that if she records him coming to the house and breaching that intervention order, you know, that evidence might not be accepted in court. So those are the sort of tricky parts of the system that we need to tighten up so that the apprehended violence order does have some teeth to it. So when it is issued, people pay attention to it.
I mean, look, I understand, but I can see the situation where the community would expect a court to establish that the fellow did in fact breach the order. And it's not always true that you can rely on one person saying, yes, he breached the order.
Exactly. So the burden of proof.
It's really hard to prove that. I mean, there would be, I would think, just guessing, intuitively saying that the vast majority of people who report the breach of an order would be telling the truth. But it's not out of reasonable supposition that there are some people who are so rightly bitter at having been beaten in the physical sense of domestic violence, that they see it as an opportunity for payback and report a breach that, in fact, hasn't occurred.
I can't say that that's never happened, but in the research that has been done internationally on false reports, it's very
small.
Rare.
Mm.
Yeah, it's very small.
Well, that's a good thing.
So, yeah. And I guess that comes back to this whole question of an intervention order, an apprehended violence order, that the burden of proof is really high, you know, in a court of law to show that there's been a breach or that the violence has occurred. And this comes back to, again, that family violence is a recent form of crime, and the courts and the justice system are still catching up with how do you actually bring proof to the court that the court will listen to.
Recently recognised as a crime. You don't actually think it's only recently started to happen, do you?
No, it's not that it's recently started to happen.
Recently recognised as a crime.
Recognised in the courts and justice system. I mean, we haven't gone that far beyond, you know, women and children being property of men.
Indeed. If there was one recommendation ought to be implemented, what would you say it ought to be?
I think it's for the men. I guess I'm focusing particularly at the moment on recognizing the different forms of violence other than the physical. I mean, the physical is really important to deal with, but the other forms of violence and those men who you can't actually put them through a justice response necessarily, but you refer them into a program of some description, and I can say other things about programs, but we're not monitoring that. So if he's asked to attend a program, he may only need to attend for an assessment, and he may not actually attend the whole program, but he's only asked if he ever attended. And whether he finishes the program is not really monitored either. There might be a letter that says, yes, he attended, or he completed, but not whether he absorbed the material. So I think we need to come up with a system.
But how do you get someone to do that? Just I understand what you're saying, that physical violence is not the only type of domestic violence, but just take someone who is, if you like, abusive and becomes violent around the house but not to the person, you know, such that there is an apprehension on that person's part as to what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
What do you just march in and say to this guy, listen, you're behaving badly, I think you need to go to counselling? What on earth makes you think he will?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's the...
So we can set up this service, but how are we going to get them there?
Well, that's what's happening at the moment in the courts where they're going for intervention orders. And again, this is part of that process for apprehended violence orders, which is actually important, where the magistrate may say to him, I'm going to give you an intervention order and I want you to attend a program. I don't have any evidence.
But that's only someone who's in the courts. How do you get someone into the court who's perpetrated the type of domestic violence to which you refer,
mm-hmm.
which is not in itself physical?
Mm-hmm. Well, there we come back.
How do they end up before a magistrate who orders them to this counselling? Part of my concern with this is it's all very well to have this service, but I just can't see how you're going to get a perpetrator there.
No, you're absolutely right. There's only a small percentage who end up in the courts and justice system. So that comes back to looking at community attitudes and the way that we think and talk about violence in the community or abuse in the community and starting to make the conversation so that it's not okay to be doing these sorts of behaviors. And people notice them. They don't minimize and deny them. They start to see them. And we have conversations in our social groups, and we call people to account for it. And then we might start to get, and I guess this is where a lot of the programs are trying to go. They're trying to get men to self-refer, to identify them in themselves that there's an issue that they want to deal with.
Good luck with that.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying that it's an easy pathway.
No, it's not easy. It isn't easy at all, and it is a concern. I understand what you say, that domestic violence is in part physical, largely physical, but there's this other element, financial control, for example, women who've got no idea about family finances and are kept out of it and kept on a shoestring budget so that he can spend all the money, if you like, at the pub or the races or on himself, whatever.
Or just that.
It's terrible, but I just can't see how we get into that because we, the society that is, might not hear about it and it's not an offence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, again, if we come back to people's understanding of what constitutes violence, what's coercive and controlling behaviour, and having those conversations, instead of always focusing on the physical or the sexual assault, that we actually look at this continuum of behaviors that may start with something that's slight or subtle. It might be an isolation or controlling behavior, financial abuse or something that may escalate into something physical. It may not. It may always stay non-physical. But we tend to minimize or say that that's not as important as the physical violence. But in fact, a lot of women talk about that the impact on them emotionally is worse than the physical abuse. I mean, we still have 3/4 of Australians who don't understand why women stay in an abusive or violent relationship. So they don't really understand what choices a woman's making if she's thinking about leaving, how that will have implications for if she has got children, what that will mean, her finances, her housing, homelessness, those decisions. And then the fear, so if he is threatening, if she does leave, is that going to increase her risk?
It's a tremendous change, isn't it? I mean, if you're looking at asking someone to move in their job, you have to consider whether their spouse has a job and the kids are in school, and that therefore means maybe the whole family has to move. Mm-hmm. So moving is a really important step to take. And just to say to a woman, well, why don't you move out? I mean, okay, if she's had her jaw broken 3 times or something, I can see why people say that, but it isn't an easy move, is it?
Not at all, not at all. And if she doesn't have an income or a stable income and she's got young children to look after, how does she think about supporting herself?
Well, look, I'd like to say it's been a pleasure. You're obviously a very nice person. It hasn't been an unhappy conversation because of you. It's been an unhappy conversation because of the topic. We've been on this for decades and we still haven't cracked it. But look, thanks for joining us today on Counterpoint.
Thanks for having me and engaging with the issue.